Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NWA Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lowther, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NWA Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast, the podcast of the NWA Deterrence Center. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and today we have Chris Stone. Now, Chris is the host of another podcast called Real Space Strategy. So if you've never checked it out, make sure you check it out. Chris focuses on, you know, space issues, but, you know, like many space folks, he spent his time in the nuclear world as well. And Chris listened to the episode where I got to be the guest and talk about dynamic parity. And he even went the extra step and read the dynamic parity strategy. And so he contacted us. Of course, I know Chris. And he said, hey, we should have let's do an episode where we debate dynamic parity because I think you're missing some stuff. And I said, that'd be a great episode. So let's do it. So, Chris, welcome to NucleCast.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
So, you know, dynamic parity is a, you know, this is a strategy that Curtis McGiffin and I sort of devised. And, you know, I think I said in the podcast, you know, it's what we thought was the minimum necessary to achieve effective deterrence. So, you know, we may always aspire, you know, like I've said before, I wish the United States was the only country in the world that had nuclear weapons. But in an environment absent where that's true, we thought dynamic parity would be an effective approach. Now, there were some areas where you thought, you know, Adam, I may think you're a good guy, but I think you got this one wrong. So, Chris, let me turn it over to you and let's go through that.
Sure. So, as you did mention, I do have a little bit of nuclear background. So I did missiles briefly when space and missiles was one mission area. But so, and I'm also sort of a graduate of the Defense and Strategic Studies program. So I've been educated by proteges of Herman Kahn and others like Keith Payne and things of that sort. So, so a lot of my ideas already kind of synced with his, and that's probably part of the reason why I thought, hey, I want to go read from this. But so there are a couple of things that I noticed that I thought was interesting in the paper. One thing is I'm not a fan of the word parity. And, so in my mind, parity should never be a goal of the United States when it comes to military related stuff. And in my mind, when you look at how the shelling mindset of parity in the Cold War happened, it didn't really work out so well. And I don't think it'll work now, especially, you know, back then you had 1.5 powers of concern, the Chinese early days and the obviously then Soviet Union, now Russia. Superiority and having the ability for escalation dominance is key for credible deterrence. I mean, I've read other people who have tried to redefine deterrence to mean something it never was and never will be. And I don't see how being equal with your adversary, even though in this case the paper talks about the U.S. being equal to 3 countries combined, I still, based on all the logic of our former forebears, who seem to understand that the whole point of the weapon systems is to be sort of an insurance policy, that obviously you don't want to exhaust your insurance policy on one problem. You want to have enough of a coverage that you can use it for multiple events. So if deterrence fails, you got to have the ability to win the war. And if you're equal to all three, which have been working together more tightly lately, you're not going to be dealing with them individually, most likely. If you have parity, only takes one small advantage to shift the apple cart in favor of the enemy, and then we lose. So one thing to remember that I've noticed in 15 plus years of working out here is that if you want something to be certain in a way of force posture, or you want to have a certain number of weapons, or you want to have a certain number of personnel, that you have to ask for way more than the minimum that you need and then negotiate down to somewhere. You don't start at the minimum as a way to try to convince people. So it's just a reality. And unless your side has super majorities in both houses of Congress, even then it can be a challenge because you get guys or girls that decide they want to show their own independence, and then that creates problems. But you likely won't get everything anyway. But arguing for parity with the combined forces of the top four threats, I don't think is very wise. The next thing I'll mention briefly is arms racing.
Well, let's take them one at a time. We don't want to overwhelm the listeners, you know.
All right.
So let me address sort of your premise of parity, because this is one that other people have brought up. And they said, hey, man, we don't like this idea that all you want is parity. Clearly, superiority is better. And sort of in principle, I agree with you. I always want to have more than, you know, than the adversary in the conventional realm and the nuclear realm. But our premise was to be, in some respects, pragmatic, in that we thought parity was a stretch, you know, trying to achieve parity with, you know, Russia. You know, for example, Russia can break out at any time, and they can break out effectively. They can manufacture pits. They've got all their industrial base has already modernized, you know, 90%+ of their nuclear force. So they have a capability that we really haven't proven that we can do. Then we've got, you know, the Chinese. I think the Chinese numbers are significantly higher than we're told. And if, you know, let's suppose that in this new relationship between Russia and China, that, you know, enriched uranium and plutonium, you know, or pits or whatever, however they want to ship it, but that special nuclear material is given, you know, to the Chinese to speed up their building of weapons. Our ability to effectively counter that it's just non-existent. We couldn't match. So we thought our stretch goal was parity, because we thought superiority is effectively unachievable. So we thought, rather than shooting for what's sort of the popular thing now is strategic sufficiency, you know, which is, you know, if I only need one ICBM to take out, you know, six silos, you know, that have six Chinese ICs, and each of those ICs has, let's say, four warheads or four reentry vehicles, then I only need one for 24. That's sort of the strategic sufficiency argument. We're saying, no, you need more than that. That's fundamentally insufficient. But that's sort of the predominant view right now, strategic sufficiency. And we're saying, no, you got to shoot for more. And so our premises was not necessarily in fundamental disagreement with you of superiority, but just that, you know, dynamic parity would be a pretty heavy reach. And so we thought, you know, let's not go for the extreme. Let's go for something more reasonable, but it's still a stretch goal. And so, and then even, you know, if we look at, like, go back to the 1970s and 80s, you know, it was like Harold Brown, you know, when he said, you know, we build, they build, we stop, they build. And, you know, late in the Cold War, the Soviets had, 31 or 32, and we had 24. And there comes a point at which you say, well, you know, another 5,000 or 6,000 is not going to, you know, we're all going to perish anyway. So we don't really need to build beyond. Now, I don't think we're at that point now, and we're not. It's certainly, and I'm really concerned about tactical nuclear, our tactical nuclear deficit. That's where I think the biggest gap that the Russians and the Chinese think they can fill or think they can sort of coerce us is in that area. So I would like to see us build capability there. Mm-hmm. And that's where we need the biggest ramp up, I would submit. And so, that's sort of just our take was not in fundamental disagreement with you, but just in thinking about where are we in our modernization, right? We haven't fielded a single modernized, you know, weapon and delivery vehicle yet. And we're mm-hmm. 15 years into modernization. So our view that we could get through Congress and then effectively do it in terms of fielding a superior arsenal was one, you know, we just thought, I don't know that we could do either one of those.
Yeah, well, I get that, but here's the thing. On the on the pragmatic side, I personally think that the not this most recent NPR nuclear posture review, but the one before, the one during the last administration.
Yeah.
Because I know a few guys who were on that, and they told me that the reason why they were pushing for the buildup of the tactical so-called non-strategic nukes was because we had more capability to build that in shorter term than the big guns.
Yeah.
And that was a way to fill the gap in numbers until we could get to dealing with the big guns. And I understand that. I think that was that was a decent idea, and I think that was good until the current administration killed it. Which I thought was unwise, as the, you know, other side continues to build up, somehow our goodness is going to prevail despite the fact that we're going to be, you know, overloaded. But the other thing is about the big guns. Yeah, we have Sentinel, supposed to replace the missile I'm familiar with, which is Minuteman III. And I just, you know, we are not even close to parity on that, on the big guns. I think personally, from everything that I've heard from friends related to Sentinel, is I don't know why they decided they needed to build a brand new missile, because basically the Minuteman III that are in the hole right now are pretty much new missiles, because we've, back when I was a missileer, we were replacing the first stage and all the different stages. We replaced the MGS guidance can. We replaced everything except pretty much the warheads. Has been updated, and of course we had to, you know, maintain but not update the launch facilities and things, and so instead of just fixing the missile, they want to fix everything. So that's what's slowing us down. I just personally, I don't understand the decision making for that, and that's what's slowing us down. But I think, back to your point about numbers, one thing that I've learned a great deal from reading such books on Thomas Power, who was the SAC commander back in the early 60s, is one of his arguments was, and of course now understand our missiles and everything have more precision because we've gotten better with that. But at the same time, if you're talking about a percentage of kill, percentage of destruction, even with our precision, with so few weapons, and it's being self-restrained to one warhead per missile, despite the other side blowing it off completely, I think you're still having a lower percentage of destruction on targets, and you're only going to have so much left if you get into an exchange with one of the three, that you're not going to have a credible deterrent left over, because you're not going to want to, unless it's a really, really bad day, you're not going to all call enable everything and fire everything. So I just think that parity is if you get to parity, you're not going to be at what you need for the percentage of destruction. You're not going to be psychologically where you need to be to overwhelm them in their minds. Because from what I've read and understood from years of working this area is the Russians and the Chinese have lots and lots of people. And they have not so much the Russians, but the Chinese especially. And they have a different philosophy on, you know, just acceptable losses, I guess I'll put it.
Yeah.
Casualties. And so, yeah. And especially the Chinese. So if we're all worried about, oh, we're going to hurt them. Well, yeah, that's kind of the point. And if they're not psychologically worried about it because they have, you know, X number of billion people and they're willing to sacrifice them, or the Russians just, you know, are willing to push the bluff because of, you know, obviously if you're dealing with a country who doesn't care about civilian casualties, like just look at Aleppo. You know, they're bombing and leveling a whole city in Syria just to get after a few people. They're not really worried about precision. So I don't think that they would be in agreement with that. If we go for parity, they're still going to go for more. And I don't think that would be a wise choice. And with a stretch goal, I get that concern. But again, as I've seen, if you want, I really don't think we've been modernizing, to be honest with you. We've just been updating things. There's a difference between just updating a few parts here and there and actually modernizing. I think I was on another program with you where another person commenting said that we need to get back to actual testing and not just modeling and sim. I mean, we've got all these things that we need to be doing for deterrence, and we're not doing it because we're trying to be a kinder, gentler thing, and it's not the world we live in. So, but anyway, yeah. that's parody. I have more to say, but I also have like three other points.
Yeah, there's the only other thing I would say is in parody, we wanted superiority in, you know, if you look at reliability and effectiveness and, you know, like you said, better CEPs, better probabilities of kill than Russian weapons. I mean, we've seen, and we really don't know that much about Chinese systems, how effective they are, but we've seen that Russian systems, you know, there was a Sarmat failed test. You know, there's problems that the Russians can have. And so therefore that creates the potential for us to have superiority just in the quality of our assets. So, I mean, that was sort of the way we wanted to do it. And then we were thinking in psychological terms, because how do we prevent arms racing? And we thought, you know, if we essentially give the adversary, you know, this mechanism of, hey, what we'll be a peer, we won't seek superiority, and then therefore if you move down because you don't want to go in this direction, we'll follow you. And so it's also, we wanted to create a mechanism where you don't have to have specified arms control, that you can build into the approach a mechanism for reductions. Now we're at the halfway point of this episode, and as always, we like to try to take a quick break. So you're listening to NucleCast, and I'm Adam Lowther, and Chris Stone's with me today, and we'll be right back. This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLAW Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence. And we're back, and we're talking to Chris Stone, and he reached out and said, hey, I want to talk dynamic parity. I heard the episode, read the paper, and I had some questions. So we talked about the idea of parity in the first half of the show. Now, you had some other points you wanted to bring up.
Yeah.
So I'll turn it back over to you, Chris.
Sure. So you had mentioned before the break preventing arms races, and that was another one of my thoughts. Is there's, in my mind, there's nothing wrong with an arms race, especially if the enemy is already engaged in such behavior. So,
which they are, by the way, they are.
Correct.
They're outracing us.
So if the language you're using is trying to appease a certain group of folks within the policy sphere of the United States and Europe, they need to understand that, you know, just because you choose not to run doesn't mean that you're not in a race.
Yeah.
And as you know, and you should be wanting to win the race. So if the adversary is about numbers, then numbers are important. So even if you want to make the argument that numbers aren't important, we have quality, it's not going to impact the adversary because they have more and they could saturate us in their minds. And therefore, who cares if we have one or two that can hit the target better than theirs when they can go old school and saturate. I mean, if you're not competing, you're forfeiting. And just say, it's like trying to run a race as a guy who used to run cross country. It's like, you know, you're at a race and you're prepared and you've got the right shoes and you got the uniform on, but you're not willing to actually run it. You're still going to lose. So,
yeah, no, I mean, I don't fundamentally disagree with you. The challenge is we don't have the right shoes and we don't have the uniform and we haven't trained. I mean, let's be honest, we haven't trained to run this race. We've essentially done nothing. And what we've done is we've watched our adversaries, you know, train day after day. We've watched them go out and build these super cool uniforms that wick sweat away and do all these cool things. And they've got these great shoes that are, you know, the best out there. And then they're like, okay, we're taking off. And we're like, but we mean you, we don't feel like we need to beat you, right? We just want to be friends. We want to be your friend. We don't want to have to race because we want everybody to get a trophy.
Yeah.
We don't want there to be winners and losers, right?
Well, that's not a good way to think in this world.
But
in
that's
this
how
particular,
that's, that's where we are in this country. And so our premise is, hey, let's start training. Let's start, you know, let's go after some athletic gear. Let's get some good shoes. And then let's try to at least run with the, you know, other folks, at least run with them. I mean, it's not that we don't, that Curtis and I don't want to win. It's that we can't even, you know, get people to believe that we should run with people, with our adversaries. Yeah. That's the challenge. And even today, even in this modern world, as you know, you've still got the disarmament community advocating to eliminate the Sentinel program and eliminate ICBMs. And I keep wondering, like, why do you hate ICBMs? I've always wondered, why do you hate ICBMs? Do you understand that our adversaries, that's where they primarily focus their nuclear arsenals? So there's got to be some value to them because our adversaries put their eggs in that basket.
And they're expanding them too.
Yeah. The capabilities. And, you know, that's part of the reason Sentinel is, at least to me, important, is because it has the ability to penetrate advanced air defenses in a way that Minuteman doesn't, through a whole set of, you know, capabilities we can't really talk about here. But it's just, you know, it's unfathomable to me, the debate that we're having in this country, which is a debate that the Russians and the Chinese and the North Koreans and the Iranians are not having.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing about arms races is the phrase in the report, arms reacting.
Sure.
When you're dealing with a threat from a proactive enemy like the Chinese, whose mentality is attack to deter, and that's in space, but it's also everywhere else. That's another proposition for losing that I think we need to educate these people on. And that's why podcasts like this exist and people need to lobby like crazy, because we've had 30 years of habit of thinking it's a nice to have. It's not an important part of our defense, our architecture. And, you know, there have been several books that people apparently haven't been reading about the second nuclear age. And some people argue there's a third. About how the utility of a nuclear weapon, whether big or small, has increased, not decreased. And the fact that you see proliferation, obviously the Proliferation Security Initiative and the Missile Technology Control Regime clearly are not working, as we're seeing those three countries, you know, swapping missiles and components and selling them and all sorts of stuff. So if you're always responding, then you're behind the curve all the time. And there is another book that it's old. And I think some of the authors have passed, unfortunately. It's called Winning the Technological War. I think it was by Purnell, if you're familiar with Purnell. And basically he was saying that arms races is essentially a technological war. It's no different. Arms races is a term that arms control people use. That sounds bad in the minds of people, but all it is staying ahead of the, it's basically that whole struggle between offense and defense. You know, if someone has a superior offense, you have to build a better defense to counteract that, and then vice versa. And that process keeps going and going and going. Well, that's just how life is in the international system. That's not abnormal. That's normal. And so, for those that have problems wrapping their heads around, oh, arms races are bad, you got to understand that in order to mitigate those situations requires strength. It doesn't require you to say, hey, we should ban things, because as I've mentioned on numerous posts and LinkedIns, and sometimes I think maybe even on your program, is Hague and Geneva and all these other treaties. These two particular, the biggest ones, China and Russia, have a notorious history of using them as long as it gives them time to rearm, and then they abrogate it and they're like, oh, we don't care. And that's why most of these post-Cold War treaties are dead. You know, even if we are still clinging on to some of them, they're dead because of the other player that is the problem, not us. So you can't expect people to follow our lead when they haven't been following our lead for 30 years. So I just think maybe it's semantics, but when you call it arms reacting, if you're reacting, you're already behind.
And yeah, our premise for arms reacting was essentially in numbers, not necessarily in capability. So our premise was that you have to essentially return your nuclear enterprise to what it was, you know, during the Cold War, in its ability to constantly be building and replacing warheads, constantly be building and replacing delivery vehicles, such that you're always ahead in the technology, because every 10 years or so you're replacing systems, mm-hmm. and your technology is better. Our reacting is focused on numbers, in the sense that if the Russians were to say, hey, we want to go down, you know, let's say the Russian economy tanks again, or because their population is tanked, they just can't afford it, or the oil dries up, you know, mm-hmm. whatever the thing may be, and they say, hey, we want to go down 1,000. Then we say, okay, you go down, we'll go down. So we would react to their desire to move down. Or if they say, hey, we can't field a conventional force, so therefore we're going to build up, then we'll say, okay, we'll build up. But the idea is our technology is still better.
Yeah, well, that relates to another thing when you said mitigate in the report, mitigate advantage without seeking American advantage. The problem is most of these previous arms control treaties when we respond to things like that, is they always end up with higher numbers than we do. We're always willing to take a lower number.
We have, that's true.
And the whole point of advantage is advantage. And you could say we have better technology, but if it's not deployed, who cares? You know, like in the space world, we keep talking about, oh, we have space superiority and technological capability. Great. None of that's deployed. We have no weapon systems deployed. So you could say we have better quality, but if we still are lower in numbers and lower in the ability to with a high enough survival rate of a first strike or something, then you're not good. That's another reason why the SAC guys asked why we had so many ICBMs back in the day. It wasn't because they thought we needed them just for, I mean, there were several reasons. One of them was survivability. Second was because you had to have a probability of kill. And if you really wanted 100% or at least 90% with the bombers and everything like that, all working together, you know, the bombers might get intercepted. The missiles might fail. You know, there's all sorts of things that could happen. And in order to make sure that you were in a position that you weren't going to get a bunch of duds, you had to have enough of them. We in the post-Cold War thought, oh, well, this is not really a big deal anymore, so we can deal with, you know, 450 missiles in one wing now instead of, you know, 2,000 spread across whatever. And now we have just three locations that everybody knows.
You bring up a good point, and it goes back to this. So if you go, I think I've mentioned this numerous times, and that is that, you know, during the Vietnam conflict, it took 55,000 rounds of small arms ammunition to kill each, you know, NVA soldier. And, so we clearly needed, it was not a one-to-one ratio. One bullet, one kill. That was never the way it worked. And then here, you know, Curtis was looking at this. And during OIF, OEF, we expended 250,000 rounds per kill in those conflicts. So it got, you needed more, five times more than you needed in Vietnam. And in our era of, you know, precision and stuff, you needed a lot more. And so this view that, you know, we've got 1,000 targets, we've got 1,000 weapons, and 1,000 weapons on 1,000 targets. That's just how it works. One weapon, one kill. And it's never worked that way in warfare. It's never worked that way.
Especially when you're not postured like we are. Like our bombers aren't postured for like a 3-minute takeoff like they used to. We're not postured even, you know, for any of that. Frankly, we rotate, as I understand it by the public releases, we just rotate. Now there is talk about bringing them on alert. I think one of the senators or congressmen was talking about that, and I'm like, great, but we only have like 60 bombers where we used to have thousands of them. By the way, I will say that with your point that you made about when I was talking about the lead by example, I know you guys agree with me on that. I there was a great statement in there that I do agree with, that 30 years is, you know, obviously failed to convince the adversary that leading by example does anything. I agree with that. I also agree with your position on arms control agreements influencing behavior. So I don't disagree with everything in the paper. I just want you to know that. But I thought, I think if you want more, like I said, well, you want it just, more. It's just a fact of life. If you want to not be destroyed, Congress, then you're going to have to change your priorities and fund things that you need. And if you want to get, I mean, minimum deterrence and nuclear zero, that's over with. That 30-year pipe dream is dead. Because we're being encircled as we speak by a combined fleet of Chinese and Russian airplanes and ships. By the way, if you aren't seeing it in the news, you have to look for it, but it's there on their major exercise. And they're penetrating our air defense zones again with their bombers. They're drop launching missiles to demonstrate they can. And yet we're acting like it's still the 1990s when the Russians can't do anything. So obviously the biggest exercise since the 1970s, and people are still sleeping, it seems.
I'll be honest with you. I think that the fundamental reason we're seeing this sort of ostrich strategy is because if you look at the federal budget and state budgets, right? So the federal budget, about 70% of the federal budget is in mandatory spending. It's, you know, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and then other handout programs. And then if you look at state budgets, 40% of each of the 50 states' budgets is in welfare programs. Just the welfare programs. And that doesn't even include all the other things where we redistribute income. So if you look at the $8.5-9 trillion, well, if you include all that we borrow, it's 10 or 12 trillion that the federal and state governments spend. You know, 2/3 of it or more is in redistribution of income. And so for a member of Congress to go to that huge voting block and say, hey, we're going to stop giving you free money. Now, you know, Social Security and Medicare, that's a very complex topic that, you know, it's sort of not free, but in many cases, it eventually becomes free money because of how they've built those programs. But that who are defense advocates are not a big enough voting block to go to Congress and say, you know, vote to stop the Russians and the Chinese and spend less on, you know, these entitlement programs. It's so for members of Congress, they would rather just keep their head in the sand, hope that we have a minimum enough to keep them at bay because they're trying to win the next election. And this is what you see. This is the fundamental problem. This is why we're in the position we're in, is because entitlement programs buy more votes than defense programs do. And that's it.
I would say just quickly that I think there's enough federal budget that even in the Department of Defense and Energy and everything else, that if people would prioritize things, or then we would be able to make it work. Like, here's an example. Between the services, you know, it's not an equal pie share.
True.
So in the 1950s, when they were building up Strategic Air Command, the Air Force, the SAC piece of the Air Force, got a majority of the defense budget.
Yeah, it did.
Because they had to build it up rapidly in order to make sure that we weren't schwacked by the Soviet Union. And they had plenty of education and decent public relations to explain why, hey, the Russians could attack at any time because this is their nature, thanks to the Kennan telegram. And we need to be prepared for this. Otherwise, we're all going to get killed because this is a different situation. This is not, the oceans aren't going to protect us. And we've been hearing that forever. The oceans aren't going to protect us. But then we go back to sleep again because we tell everybody we're fine all of a sudden, and we're not. So it's their responsibility as representatives to not only represent the interest, but to make sure that, hey, this is what I'm hearing from the executive branch on our threats. And until we can get that message out, you know, they have to make the best decisions they can. But then if we end up getting destroyed, they're going to say, why didn't you do this? It's the same old thing. So I don't even think that Social Security and all the other stuff is as big of a deal. I also would mention, I don't know if you knew this, but most of the states, half of their budgets are actually come from federal money.
Yeah.
I don't know if you knew that or not, because the federal government gives the states money to make them follow federal rules instead of the states doing their own thing. It's sort of like if you do what we say, we'll give you cash and you can use it in your state budgets. Oh, okay, great. So at least I know in one state that I'm from, that's the case. It may not be in every state, but
yeah, anyway. In those entitlement programs, it's usually about a 60-40 or 55-45, kind of like Medicare and Medicaid particularly. So, and then there's some with education and, but I get your point. Although I'm probably more skeptical in, you know, I mean, we have this golden mean with the services that's, you know, popped up. And if you look at defense spending, it's been consistently on the decline as a percentage of the total budget. And,
yeah,
you know,
GDP.
Even as a percentage of the budget, not just GDP, but as a percentage of the budget, it's, you know, it's been on the decline, you know, and so it's one of those things where I don't see how you change that, you know, given American politics today. And this is a, you know, if you look at Europe, you know, we're sort of 20 years behind Europe. And, you know, this is the European problem today. How do they fund them? They can't tax more because they already tax it at rates that, you know, sort of, you know, they violate the Laffer curve already. So I'm not sure how they fix that. So it's a great question. It's been unfortunately we're at the 36 minute mark. So we've gone over time. We try to stay NucleCast is that, you know, on the way to work or on the way home podcast that you can listen to. And so we don't want to violate that rule. And so Chris, thanks for reaching out. Thanks for coming on and having a great discussion. I have a feeling a lot of folks sort of who read the dynamic parity report thought sort of similar to the way you did. And they want superiority. And so thanks for coming on and giving voice to those concerns. It was a great discussion.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Of course, I also want to thank you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.